It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll find out what's behind the recent outbreak of measles here in the United States.
First, for supporters of campaign finance reform and critics of money in politics, there hasn't been a lot of positive news lately. Court decisions at the state and federal levels have ended limits on campaign money to candidates and to outside organizations.
Our next guest has been making the case for reform for years, and now he's trying a new tactic, a political action committee that's raising money to support candidates who pledge to help get money out of politics. Lawrence Lessig is with us. He's law professor at Harvard. His books include Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Our Congress and a Plan to Stop It. And he's the founder of the new Mayday Political Action Committee. Lawrence Lessig, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
Well, before we get to the how of what you're doing, let's start with the why. Can you make the case that money, political money, has a corrupting influence on politics and Congress in particular?
Well, it's important to be clear about why or how it has this influence. The problem with American politics today is that we have outsourced the funding of campaigns to the tiniest fraction of the 1%. I estimated for my book that it was about 150,000 Americans who are the relevant funders of campaigns, the funders who fund at a level large enough that candidates really care about what their particular views are. 150,000 is about the same number of people in the United States who are named Lester, right? So we outsource the funding of campaigns to this tiny, tiny fraction of the 1%, but members of Congress spend anywhere from 30 to 70% of their time talking to this tiny, tiny fraction of the 1% to get the money they need to run their campaigns. That creates the corrupting influence. It's not corruption in the old-fashioned, you know, bribery or Rob Blagojevich sense of corruption. It's corruption in plain sight because they are so obsessively focused on how to get money from this tiny, tiny fraction that they lose touch with how to give the rest of America what the rest of America cares about.
And as we mentioned, the court system, especially the U.S. Supreme Court, has been loosening restrictions on campaign money, including the total aggregate amount someone that you're talking about could give to multiple campaigns. They say it's a form of free speech. Political spending is free speech. Is it?
Yeah, so I think the Supreme Court has actually done a lot of damage here. It's made it much harder for Congress to try to address this problem. But I personally agree with some of the core principles the court has articulated. I certainly think that the government needs to be tested. One needs to be skeptical whenever the government tries to regulate speech, especially political speech. And I don't have any hesitation in saying that if the government's going to try to control speech or restrict it, it needs to meet a very, very high standard. But the critical point to recognize is that everything the Supreme Court has done to strike down limits on speech has really nothing to do with the kind of problem that I'm talking about, which is the problem of how we fund elections. Because we could change the way we fund elections tomorrow, and the Supreme Court would have no problem with it, right? So there are Democratic proposals for how to change the way we fund elections. There are Republican proposals. Republican proposals are basically voucher proposals, where you basically give voters vouchers, $50, $100, maybe even higher, that they can use to give to candidates who agree to fund their campaigns with small contributions only. The Democratic proposals are more matching grant proposals, where if you donate $100, it gets matched by the government at 5-to-1 or 9-to-1, depending on the proposal. Those two kinds of solutions would radically increase the number of funders to campaigns and therefore would reduce the influence of that tiny, tiny fraction of the 1%. And all of that, the Supreme Court has said again and again, is perfectly legal under our Constitution because it's not about restricting anybody's speech. It's just about enabling a wider range of people to participate in the political speech.
So to nail down the goal, you're not looking for new laws that would restrict someone's ability to give money. You're looking for laws that would expand the number of people who could give some money to campaigns.
Absolutely, because the structure we've got right now has produced this radically unstable system of government. And it's unstable for Democrats as well as for Republicans. This is not partisan. No matter what side you are on, the thing to recognize is you cannot get from your government what you want in a sensible way, so long as this is the way you fund elections. I mean, Democrats see this when they think about like climate change legislation, which it's obvious we will never get climate change legislation until we change the way campaigns are funded. Even Jim Hansen, the leading scientist pushing for climate change legislation, in his latest book says the number one reason we cannot get climate change legislation is because of the way campaigns are funded. But also on the right, you know, if you're on the right and you want smaller government or simpler taxes, you need to recognize that those objectives are impossible in a world where Congress benefits from more expansive regulation and more complicated taxes, because those two things make it easier for members of Congress to pull change that flush money into the political system. So whether you're on the right or the left, this way of funding elections guarantees our government can't do anything sensible and leaves us in this stalemate of partisan extremism that has totally just made it impossible for our government to function.
So that takes us to the May Day PAC. What is it, and what are you trying to do?
Well, about a year ago, a bunch of us said, what would it take to win a Congress committed to fundamental reform in 2016? You know, it's hard to imagine it being done, but just, you know, if you went district by district and you figured out where members of Congress are, and if they're not with you, then what it would take to beat them, and how many would you have to beat to get to a majority in both houses, or at least 218 in the House and 60 votes in the Senate, because the Senate's a supermajority body, the way it functions today. The question was, what would that take? How much would that cost? And the firm that we retained for doing that said, well, here's the number, and it was a very big number, much less than I thought it would be, about a third of what I thought it would be. But anyway, they said, this is the number. But they said the critically important thing you need to do is in 2014, you need to run a serious campaign in about five districts so that we can learn which messaging works, what's the way to intervene in a way that rallies people to this cause. But more importantly, that sends a message to the rest of Congress that we're going to be back in 2016 and you better be on the right side of this issue. So the firm sort of looked at that and said it would be about $12 million to be able to run those five campaigns. And to beat incumbents or to support challengers or oppose challengers who oppose reform, but candidates to make these campaigns about reform, be about $12 million. And someone suggested to me, why don't you try to kickstart that? Why don't you try to raise it in small dollar contributions to measure how much the public really cares about this issue? So we announced a kind of complicated structure. I said, we're going to try to raise $1 million in 30 days for the purpose of demonstrating to people that people care about this issue. And if we raise that $1 million, then I'll find ways to match it. So we'll have $2 million. And then we're going to try to raise $5 million in 30 days. And if we get that $5 million raised, then I'd find $5 million to raise that. And so in those two ways, we would get to the $12 million. Now, when I announced this in April or in March at the TED conference, people told me, you know, it's a great thing you're trying to do, but you're insane. You're just insane. There is no way people are going to open up their credit card and support you to raise $1 million to support the idea of trying to take on money in Congress. But I said, look, we got to try because our government has failed. We have no government. We have no effective government. If they're not going to change themselves, we've got to try to do it. So on May 1st, May Day, we launched our May Day call, basically a May Day on this democracy, May Day as in, rescue us. We opened it on May 1st with no promotion, with no advertisement, basically a blog post, a web page, and tweets and emails among friends. And within 2 days, we had raised $300,000. And then the demand was so great that our servers melted, and this incredible team of volunteer techies, geeks from around the country got together to rebuild the servers so that we would have a robust enough system to bear the demand that we saw. And so we reopened after the weekend, and we raised the $1 million in 13 days, basically more than 2 weeks ahead of schedule. Astonishing everybody. We raised from 13,000 people. Average contribution was about $75. The median was about $50. We had more than 3,500 people who gave $20 or less. This was the most incredible response to a call for this kind of reform that this reform community has seen anywhere. And what we're hoping to do starting on June 4th is to launch the second round, which will raise $5 million in 30 days, or by Independence Day, we want to be in a position to be able to declare once again our independence and to try to push for a kind of Congress we have a reason to trust.
We're talking to Lawrence Lessig, talking about the new May Day Political Action Committee aimed at reducing the influence of money, wealthy people in particular, on politics. Coming up in just a few, we'll find out what they're going to do with the money they raised, how they would target it on congressional campaigns.
And you can join in, too. What do you think about the role that campaign money plays in American politics these days? Do you have a question as to how the May Day PAC would work? Is it enough to overcome what many see as an overwhelming tide of money that is coming from a very small portion of the population? Give us a call. Join in the discussion at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post comments on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We continue our conversation now with Lawrence Lessig about campaign finance and his new project, the May Day Political Action Committee.
The goal of the committee, raising money now and then eventually supporting congressional candidates, just a few in this cycle and a lot more in 2016, hoping to bring candidates into Congress who support fundamental changes in the way campaigns are paid for in this country. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think under the current system, money in politics has, in effect, a corrupting influence? Is it bad for our ability to get things done in Congress? Do you want to see some kind of change? And what do you want to ask Lawrence Lessig about the May Day Political Action Committee? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you could post on our Central Time Facebook page. So, Lawrence, you've raised the money, say, at some point in the future. You're looking for candidates. Say I'm running for Congress, which I won't be. What would I have to do to convince you that I am on board with reform? I'm a candidate worth backing.
Well, in 2014, we're picking races that will both teach us enough so we can produce the type of data in 2016 that will convince skeptical people that we know how to win a Congress committed to reform, but also candidates who, if we beat them or if we make them win, will send a kind of shockwave through D.C. where they think, wow, we didn't think this issue was important, but the fact that so-and-so is not coming back or the fact that so-and-so is coming to Washington is a pretty good measure of just how important this issue is, at least if it's supported by this kind of citizen-funded super PAC. So that means it's kind of complicated. So we're looking at a whole bunch of districts, a whole bunch of calculations. The firm that, you know, we hired to do this initial calculation had an initial proposal of 5, but what we're going to do when we get close to being confident that we have the money we need for 2014 is we'll run the numbers again and we'll see where it makes sense. But we need to make both a powerful statement to the public, but also a meaningful statement to us so that we are confident that when we go into 2016, we have a campaign that we can win and one that we can go to the public and say, you should support this because we believe we can win.
And for all intents and purposes, this would be a political action committee subject to the same laws as anything else we call a PAC or a super PAC.
Yeah, so it's a super PAC. So that's the irony, right? Because what a super PAC can do is it's an independent political action committee, which means it can't coordinate with any candidate. So if you called me as a candidate and said, what do I need to do? I would say, I'm sorry, I'm not able to talk to you. But it's an independent political action committee. But what's special about super PACs, ever since a decision by the D.C. Circuit Court in a case called Speech Now, is that super PACs are able to accept unlimited contributions. It's not just that they can spend unlimited amounts, but they can accept unlimited contributions. So a super PAC can accept a $1 billion contribution if a billionaire wants to give it to them. Depending on how the billionaire channels his money, he can actually give him $1 billion and never identify who that billionaire is because it can come through another entity that doesn't reveal its funders. So it's a particularly vicious creature in the character of our current democracy, because what it does is further concentrate the number of relevant funders of campaigns. In 2012, 132 Americans gave 60% of the super PAC money that was spent in that election cycle. So forget the Lesters. You know, we're talking about a tiny, tiny fraction of the Lesters who are the most powerful super PAC contributors. And so what we say is, okay, look, the rules say there can be super PACs. We're going to use the rules to change the rules. We're going to use the rules to build a movement that's powerful enough to get a Congress that will find a way to change the way elections are funded, and eventually, we think, get the court to adopt systems that make it, not so you eliminate independent political action committees, but that you make it so contributions to independent political action committees are not unlimited the way they are right now.
We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We have Javier on the line in Oshkosh. Javier, hi.
Hi. Yeah, my question would be is, what is the difference or what are similarities with this other movement that's called Move to Amend? It's focusing on our legislators to also change the way contributions are being given to them for elections, because we feel that the elections are, or they feel that the elections are being controlled by money. I guess, is there a difference, or are they both going towards the same goal?
Javier, thanks for the call. Lawrence Lessig?
Yeah, so Move to Amend is an incredible organization that has done more than I think any other to rally people to the cause of fighting for fundamental reform. The particular way in which Move to Amend is trying to do that right now has been focused on getting states to pass resolutions that say to Congress, Congress, please pass a constitutional amendment to force fundamental reform into the system. Now, the product of that has been to bring literally millions of people into this movement, and I have enormous respect for what they're doing. But what the May Day PAC is trying to do is a little different. Though, you know, I certainly support the idea of amending the Constitution in the right way to fix the problems the Supreme Court has created, we think the first thing we should do is to change the way elections are funded. And we can do that without amending the Constitution. So to amend the Constitution requires Congress pass a proposed amendment with two-thirds vote, which means 67 senators would have to vote for it. And my fear is that, you know, it's my grandchildren who will see 67 senators vote for the idea of reversing something like Citizens United. But it's much easier to imagine bringing about a Congress that could pass, that could change the way we fund elections with a simple majority vote. So I think we're both aiming at the ultimate same objective, but what we're trying to do is to add a different technique, a different tactic, that in the short run we think can be much more effective because it could bring about this fundamental change just through a change in Congress.
Thanks for the call, Javier. Do you see this as a genuinely bipartisan thing? Would May Day PAC, if and when funded, support Democrats and Republicans?
Yes, we definitely. What I believe is there is no way to win this in Congress unless you have support from Democrats and Republicans alike. Now, the Democrats have more people right now who are co-sponsoring bills that are fundamental reform bills. But when you get outside the Beltway, I think the support among Republicans, at least the polling that we've seen, grassroots Republicans, is as strong for the idea of ending the system of crony capitalism or a system of corruption, as McCain used to talk about it in Washington, as are Democrats. So I think the problem in Washington is a problem that Democrats and Republicans have both contributed to. I don't think either party is innocent here. And whether or not you're a Democrat or Republican, I think if you're living outside the Beltway, you need to be pushing your candidates to support this kind of reform. And we've been recruiting Republicans, and absolutely, we will be supporting candidates to make sure that when this vote comes up after 2016, there will be a significant number of Republicans joining Democrats to make sure that this reform gets passed.
We've got Sean in Kenosha on the line now. Sean, hi.
Hey, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to comment about, I remember hearing about a big push to expand voting hours, and also there was a movement called Why Tuesday. You know, I work from 6 to 6, I have a hard time going to vote, and I am very interested in politics. I'd like to vote on Saturday.
Sean, thanks for the call. Not much time left. MediPAC focusing on the money issue. Expanded voting access, is that maybe a sidebar you'd be interested in, Lawrence?
Oh, that's an incredibly important issue. And, you know, the reality is there are about 15 really important reforms we've got to bring about. But what we've asked is, what's the first reform? What's the first reform that makes the other ones possible? And I believe we have to change the way we fund elections to get to a system where you don't have such a hyper-partisan system that might be able to consider some of these other sensible reforms, which I think obviously changing the way people vote is an incredibly important one.
Lawrence Lessig, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Lawrence Lessig, Harvard Law professor. We've got a link to his website, the May Day Political Action Committee, and you can find it on the Central Time Facebook page and leave your thoughts and comments while you're there. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Gene Purcell. And you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we are going to be taking a look at people getting into juicing. Our Food Friday guest will give us tips and recipes for making a great glass of fresh juice.
First, we take a look at some news about measles here in the United States. It was 14 years ago that the country officially achieved measles elimination, but now cases are the highest in a couple of decades.
As of May 23rd, there were 288 confirmed cases in the U.S. That's more than in all of 2013, and more than in the equivalent period of any year since 1994. And as we approach the summer travel season, that number is expected to increase. So what do we need to know about these outbreaks?
Here to give us some explanation is Dan Hopsenberger. He's director of the Wisconsin Immunization Program at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Dan, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you for having me.
Well, as we said, the CDC had considered measles effectively eliminated in the United States, but here we are with a fair amount of measles. What's behind that?
Well, from my understanding and through the documents or through the press releases from CDC, it primarily is associated with international travel. People traveling to foreign countries where measles is endemic or occurs on a regular basis and contracts the disease and brings it back to the United States. As we say with many diseases that are non-existent, or for polio, for instance, or measles that are eliminated in the United States, it's just a plane ride away, and indeed that is what's happening with measles. They contract the disease, bring it back to the United States, and associate with other unvaccinated individuals, primarily is what we're seeing now, and spread the disease to those individuals, and then it just continues to spiral.
So we're a little shy of 300 confirmed cases in the United States as a whole. Not exactly panic scenario here, but is this something that worries you looking ahead?
Well, we certainly keep our providers in Wisconsin through regular updates as to what's occurring in the United States, and that it certainly could happen here. And that any time they see someone with a rash fever illness, measles should be the first thing that they suspect, and immediately isolate the patient within their facility in a negative pressure room so as not to transmit the measles to anybody else within the facility or the staff or other patients within the facility. And then do the proper testing on the individuals to submit to the lab for lab verification, and then make sure that the person stays isolated in their home until the results are come back, either, you know, confirming that it's measles, and then the isolation continues, and then, or if it's negative, the person can be released from isolation. What we also do then, it's a communicable disease that is reported to the local health departments, and then if it's positive, the local health department will follow up with all the individuals that have been in contact with that person while they're infectious to make sure they were properly immunized and to make sure they understand what the incubation period is, which means from the time you are exposed to the disease, if you're infected, when you expect those symptoms to occur and what the symptoms are, and then to isolate yourself if indeed you feel, you know, you become ill, and then to make sure you contact the local health department.
Now, the main outbreaks around the country, I believe, are in Ohio. And as you mentioned, international travel, there was a mission group going to Philippines and brought it back there. New York, California. How much here in Wisconsin?
So far in Wisconsin, in 2014, we've had two cases, and one indeed was associated with travel to the Philippines. The other, and that was a pediatric patient, and the other one was a young adult that had exposure in, we believe, Southern California and Mexico.
You mentioned a young adult. A lot of people, and me among them, might think of measles as mainly an infant and childhood disease. I'm wrong to think that, though, right?
Correct. Correct. Our general recommendation is if you've born before 1957, you've probably had the disease, natural disease. If not, you should have, if born in 57 or later, you should have evidence of immunization. And we recommend primarily, usually, two doses of vaccine. We do have school requirements for children attending school and daycare in Wisconsin. The school requirements, or the basic requirements, are two doses upon entry to school for kindergarten.
Let's talk immunizations a little bit more. I think it was with mumps there were some cases where people had been vaccinated but lost their immunity. Can the same thing happen with measles?
The effectiveness of the vaccine for measles is pretty well documented. With the first dose of vaccine, it's estimated that we get about 96% of protection of all 96% of all people that are immunized will have protection from that first dose. But then that second dose is given to pick up the 4% or the small percentage that didn't seroconvert from the first dose. So, by and large, we're very confident with the effectiveness of the measles vaccine. It is one of the most effective vaccines I think we have right now.
If I'm a grown-up, and I don't know, I don't have the records from when I was a kid, I don't know if I was vaccinated, is there anything wrong with getting vaccinated now if I already had been vaccinated as a kid?
The bottom line that we usually recommend is if you're in an age group that a vaccine is recommended and you don't have that record in your hand or that you can prove that you've been immunized, the recommendation would be that you would get the vaccine. With anything, any vaccine that you take, or aspirin or whatever, there's a slight chance of there being a reaction. However, having previously been exposed to either disease or the vaccine is not going to increase the risk of any type of reaction. The reactions to measles vaccine are fairly insignificant.
And there's been some fear, some concern over measles and other vaccines. Links apparently spurious between the vaccines and autism. Do you want to make the case that it's a safe vaccine for kids and adults?
I think spurious is probably the word, because there's been a number of accusations on that, and through a significant amount of testing, there has been no correlation between autism and either the MMR vaccine, which was the original one. That came out from a physician in Great Britain who has since been, his license has been taken away, I guess, for manufacturing information within the study, but there's been no established links with any of the other vaccines as well.
How are our vaccination rates for measles here in Wisconsin?
Here in Wisconsin, our vaccination rates for measles are well above 90%. So we're very comfortable with our immunization rates. Now, we do have some people that personally object to the vaccine, and that is their right, by all means, or you'll have religious objections, or there are some people that can't get the vaccines because of medical reasons. And we have to be concerned about the individuals that are taking the personal exemption waiver because they may, if they contract the disease, they may easily expose someone who can't get the vaccine because of those medical reasons. And say, for instance, if the individual is immunocompromised, and measles and an infectious disease such as measles can be very serious in those individuals. So we have to be cognizant of the immunization rates in Wisconsin and make sure that we continue to promote that it's a safe and effective vaccine, and that, you know, you should avail yourself of that vaccine for yourself and your children.
I know you're making the case that we should get vaccinated just for daily life here. I've also seen suggestions that if you're not doing that, think about it as a travel precaution if you're going overseas. Is that a particularly important time to double-check and make sure we have those vaccinations?
Well, there's a number of vaccines that are recommended depending on where you travel in the world, and certainly we should, you know, any person who is traveling should check what their recommendations are for the countries that they are traveling to and get the necessary immunizations that are recommended for that country or for travel. But certainly measles with the activities in other parts of the world should be high on the list.
All right. We'll leave it there for now. Dan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, gentlemen. Have a good afternoon.
You too. That's Dan Hofsenberger. He's director of the Wisconsin Immunization Program at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services.
This is Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Trying to pack in our daily servings of fruits and vegetables can be a little daunting, but it doesn't have to be, according to our next guest.
That's right. Today on Food Friday, we're learning how to turn fresh food into tasty juices that are easy to make and also easy to take with us on the go.
Robin Asbell joins us now. She's a chef, food writer, and cooking teacher specializing in natural foods. She's the author of the new book, Juice It, Energizing Blends for Today's Juicers. Robin, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, first, make the case. Why should we add juicing to our daily diets?
Well, you know, most people have a really hard time getting in all the fruits and vegetables that they need every day. And, you know, you're hit and miss. Some days you look back on your day and say, wow, you know, I don't know if I had a green vegetable. And so it's so much easier if you just kind of start your day or, you know, figure out a time during the day when it's going to be a good time to have a big vegetable juice. You know, so it's really, and it's just quite pleasant and delicious.
I'm curious about sort of the status of juicing these days. You know, it seems like one of those things that trends that sort of come and go. Are we in sort of an up phase of juicing right now?
We are. We are. You know, it's interesting because I've been juicing for, you know, 20-some years. And so, you know, back in the day, it was all about carrot juicing. And what's really started, I think, this new interest is there's a lot more juicing of greens, you know, as people are wanting to eat all this kale and get all this great nutrition from leafy greens. And so we're blending more greens into our juices.
Do we lose anything nutrition-wise when we take the raw vegetable and juice it up?
The only thing, you know, in a good juicer that you take out is fiber. And so, you know, and fiber is good. I'm not, you know, fiber's not something that you don't need, but I already eat, you know, a high fiber diet anyway. So if you're getting plenty of fiber from other foods, it's not bad to then just concentrate all those nutrients and leave the fiber out.
So let's flip that on its head for a second. What nutrients are we missing out on when we choose other things, whether it might be junk food or alcohol or something like that, over fresh juices?
Oh, well, you know, everything. The thing about plants, you know, is that plant foods are really what your body needs. You know, it's everything from phytonutrients and, you know, anti-cancer compounds and antioxidants and vitamin C and vitamin B and all these different vitamins and things. And so if you're eating processed foods, you know, they basically deplete a lot of that because they're just nutritionally void. You know, so it's very easy with stress and lack of sleep and alcohol and different medications to really be deficient. And so juices are a great way and a delicious way to just, you know, boost that back up.
We'll get into some of the delicious recipes in a minute, but first let's talk gear, the hardware. What do we need? What are we looking for?
Well, there's kind of three different options for juicing. One is people want to use a blender, and that's really more for smoothies. There are some recipes in my book where I use a blender and then thin it to more of a juice consistency. Because I always say, you know, a smoothie is a meal and a juice is a drink. Then there are basically two different kinds of juicers. There's a high-speed juicer or the slow or masticating juicer. And so high-speed is just what it says, and that more, it's kind of finely grinds the produce and the juice goes through a screen. And that is very fast, and also it whips air into the juice a little bit. And it's not, most of them don't work as well for leafy greens. And so my preferred juicer is the slow juicer or masticating juicer because it just crushes the produce. It does not grind it. It just presses it. And so it does not oxygenate it, and it also it leaves a little bit more fiber in it, so the juice is a little thicker. So you get the fiber and the goodness of the juice.
And I don't know if you want to use name brands or anything, but is there a difference in quality? I mean, is this one of those things where you get what you pay for?
Well, you really kind of do. You know, I think for a good masticating juicer, you don't really see them new for, you know, under, you know, $150, $200. You know, you don't have to spend thousands. You can. You know, you can certainly find really amazing juicers that claim to have all kinds of benefits for, you know, $2,000, $3,000. But, you know, you don't have to go that far.
So then once you've got the gear, I know a lot of people, when they get, say, $150 juicing machine, they're going to jump in with both feet. But as I understand it, you recommend kind of getting a slow start.
Well, just with anything, you know, you want to kind of move into it, you know, make your commitment. You've got to have a plan, you know, so that you kind of make a list of things that you want to have and juices that you want to try. But sure, you know, if you jump in and start juicing in a big way, you might, you know, upset your stomach or... And you don't want any kind of bad associations with juice.
Well, speaking of bad associations, when you mentioned carrot juicing, I thought, yum, I like my carrot juice. Gene, again, now made a face.
I made a face, yes.
Can you give us a good gateway juice that gets us into the habit? It's going to appeal to a mass audience. It's going to, you know, get Gene on board with
juicing.
I'm
not going to make a face.
What's a good one to start with? It's just super yummy. No one could turn it down, Robin.
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, there's so many. And that's where I kind of, what I did in the book was really try to come up with some that would make children happy. You know, you could make the ginger pina colada from the Pure Pleasure Juice chapter, the Superfruit Sangria. You know, that's one that's just red grapes, oranges, blood oranges, and raspberries. You know, that's a really fruity one.
Are you on board with that one, Gene?
I'm making a happy face. Yeah, that actually sounds very delicious.
Yeah, that's one you sip it and sit in the sun and pretend you're in Barcelona. And I've got a blue lemonade that's blueberries and purple grapes and lemon juice, and you can use kombucha or sparkling water and crushed ice and have a refreshing blue lemonade, or the strawberry vanilla spritzer. So, you know, those are just absolutely fun juices. Or you could even try the Waldorf, which has got apple, celery, parsley, and walnut.
And so those all sound refreshing and fun, but what if you want a juice to do something practical, like give you a little shot of energy?
Sure. Well, one of my favorites is the green lemonade, and that one is apple, lemon, and spinach and cucumber. And it's just sweet enough, you know, to be delicious, and it's got the tangy lemon, and it's just loaded with spinach, you know, and it's really energizing. You just take a sip of that, and it's like you say, wow, I feel more awake.
You've got one called the Red Rush. Now, we're getting into some more hardcore veggie territory, I'll warn you. But can you tell us about that one?
Sure. Well, that one, you know, it's got some chard and beets and chili. And so chilies are known to raise your metabolism. And beets, actually, there was a big thing in the 2012 Olympics that the athletes had gotten a hold of a study showing that you actually improve your athletic performance by drinking beet juice because it helps to relax the walls of your arteries. And so the compounds in beets can help an athlete increase their performance. So between that and then you've got your, you know, the vitamin C and the tomatoes and the Swiss chard. And so it's something that you can drink and go out and run your marathon.
I love that. I used to love beet juice. I'm the only one in my family who likes beets, but that is tempting. And I didn't know it was that good for me.
And what about if you want to relax a little bit? Is there a good juice for that?
Well, I've got some relaxing juices. Like there's the Sleepy Salad, which is... Actually, we've known since Roman time that lettuce has a tranquilizing effect. So that's in the blend. And there's also Grape Night's Sleep, which is grapes and lettuce and chamomile tea. And that's, you know, a good one to help you sort of relax and start falling asleep.
Now, suppose you're out shopping for ingredients. You've got your recipes maybe with you to pick out produce. What's the best way to buy, make sure you've got good stuff for juicing?
Sure. Well, you want to make sure, because a lot of these, the benefits are in the skin, especially of, say, apples and cucumbers. So you want to get organic, you know, and just get really fresh, you know, ripe produce. And now is the time. I actually planted a juice garden And I also go to the farmer's market, and this is the time of year when you can get, you know, really great deals on really fresh produce, and you can just, you know, get your, I planted beets and carrots and kale and spinach and cucumbers, and so I can just go out in the garden and pull it right out of the ground and juice it.
And I have to say, though, we just came through a pretty long winter in Wisconsin, which just wrapped up yesterday, basically. You know, for those of us who live in some of these colder climates, what can we do during the winter months?
Well, that's when I really feel it's important to keep juicing, you know, because, yeah, I'm in Minnesota, so I know how it's been.
Yeah, it's been.
And so, yeah, it seems like we were just shoveling the other day, and now it's 85. But I've got juices in there like the Sniffle Squelcher, which is the pineapple, kiwi, orange, and echinacea tea to help you build your immunity. Because in winter, you know, it gets really easy to start eating heavy food, and, you know, you start kind of staying inside in the darkness. And so you really kind of need to, it's kind of like drinking some liquid sunshine, you know, to bring in your produce and kind of drink it.
So, Robin, before we let you go, what juice have you had or are you about to have today?
You know, today I made a kale and parsley and apple and lemon. So kind of a variation on my lemonade. And I threw a little, some ginger in there, too. I really like a little kick of ginger.
That sounds great. Robin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Robin Asbell. She's author of Juice It, Energizing Blends for Today's Juicers. And by the way, if you head over to the Central Time Facebook page, we have a link to her page. And there, if you search around, there are a bunch of great juice recipes to get you started. Check them out.